Here are the numbers. When somebody likes you, you have a 90% chance of persuading them. When somebody does not like you, you have a 10% chance of persuading them. How do you develop that contagious cooperation? Because we've all met someone who, just after a few seconds of being in their presence, we feel an instant connection or bond with them. This is the law of connectivity. We've probably all met someone that instantly we did not like and we did not want to be around. And the reality is, this could be you. People will pretend to like you. People will be nice around you. That's how they've been taught by society. But do they really like you, or are they pretending to like you? And when you don't like somebody, it's obviously caused by the lack of connectivity and usually only takes a few seconds to manifest itself. The law of connectivity states the more we feel connected to, part of, liked by, or attracted to someone, the more persuasive we become. When you create an instant bond or connection, people feel comfortable around you. They will feel like they have known you for a long time and that they can easily relate to you. When we feel connected with someone, we feel comfortable and understood. They can relate to us, and a sense of trust ensues. Now, there are four main points of connectivity: traction, similarity, people skills, and rapport. Each of these points I want to discuss. However, before we get started, it's important to note that really connecting with others requires an attitude of sincerity, a lot of practice, and a true interest in serving and helping the other person. Whatever you do, do not take your relationships with people for granted. And I'm here just to tell you the truth. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. And it might not even be politically correct. I'm just going to tell you what the studies show. The first part is attraction, or what social psychologists call the halo effect. Attraction operates by making one positive characteristic of a person affect the public's overall perception of them. Sociologists describe this as the halo effect. Because of this halo effect, people automatically associate traits of kindness, trust, and intelligence with people who are attractive. We naturally try to please people we like and find attractive. If your audience likes you, they will forgive you for your wrongs and remember your rights. In fact, studies show that people who are physically attractive are better able to persuade others. They're also perceived as friendlier, more talented, and usually have higher incomes. Attractive means more than just looking beautiful or handsome. It also encompasses having the ability to attract and draw people to you, becoming magnetic. The effect of attractiveness transcends all situations. For example, the judicial system, which is supposed to be based upon evidence, has documented cases where attractiveness made a dramatic difference. In one study done in Pennsylvania, researchers rated the attractiveness of 74 male defendants at the start of their criminal trials. Later, the researchers reviewed the court records for the decisions in these cases and found that the handsome men had received significantly lighter sentences. In fact, those researchers found that the attractive defendants were twice as likely to avoid jail time as the unattractive defendants. In the same study, a defendant who was better looking than his victim was assessed an average of fine of $5,623, but when the victim was more attractive of the two, the average compensation was twice that much. What's more, both female and male jurors showed the same bias. And the same halo effect holds true for political elections. Research was done in Canada, and it found that attractive candidates received more than 2.5 times as many votes as the unattractive candidates. When voters were surveyed about their bias, 73% denied in the strongest possible terms that they were influenced by attractiveness. Another 14% said, well, maybe it could happen. They would allow for the possibility. These are subconscious triggers. Consider these everyday examples of one's appearance influencing their circumstances. Have you ever noticed that height often seems to have some relationship to one's position? Is it interesting to note that most CEOs are over 6 foot? Did you ever notice as a child that there were some children who seemed to be able to get away with anything? Well, there's been some research showing that attractive children who misbehave are considered less naughty by adults than less attractive children. In an elementary school, teachers often presumed the more attractive children were even more intelligent than the less attractive children. When we come in contact with someone of the opposite sex, the attractiveness concept is magnified. Attractive females can persuade men more easily than unattractive ones. And attractive males can persuade females more easily than attractive males can. We see obvious examples of this all around us. At conventions and trade shows, large corporations fill their space with sexy and attractive females, also known as booth babes. In one study, men who saw a new car ad that included a seductive female model rated the car as faster, more appealing, more expensive looking, and better designed than did the men who viewed the same ad without the model. Additionally, female students who are perceived to be more attracted by the professors often receive substantially higher grades for the same work than the unattractive females. It is not uncommon for the store manager to assign attractive sales rep to the young bachelor who walks in the door. Most store managers, well, they might not admit it, hire attractive salespeople to attract more customers. Research has shown that looks matter outside advertising as well. In various studies, attractive men and women, when compared to those who were considered to be less attractive, were judged to be happier, smarter, friendlier, and more likable. They were also considered likely to have better jobs, be better marital partners, or to get more dates. The halo effect causes us to see people only in a positive way, which gives them persuasive power. Because of the way we view them, we want to be like them, and we hope for them to like us in return. The attractiveness of our clothes can invoke the law of connectivity. Researchers Fried, Chandler, Moulton, and Blake conducted a now-famous experiment on how easy it would be to encourage people to ignore a don't walk sign at a city intersection. When a well-dressed individual ignored the sign and walked into the street, 14% of the people who had been waiting for the light to change followed him across. When the same person repeated the experiment the next day, now dressed in average street clothes, only 4% of the people followed him across. And a similar effect has been found in hiring situations. In one study, the good grooming of applicants in a simulated employment interview accounted for more favorable hiring decisions than did their job qualifications. This happened even though the interviewers claimed that appearance only played a minor role in their choices. I know that when I travel, how I'm dressed is directly related to how I am treated and how often I get upgrades. I can persuade the airline attendants to give me better seats, a better flight, or the help I need much better and faster when I'm in a suit than when I'm wearing casual attire. When I have on jeans and a t-shirt, I'm viewed as less attractive. As a result, I get less cooperation. Not only can we focus on other abilities to make us appear more attractive, but we also can increase our physical attractiveness in many different ways. Let me explain. Attractiveness lies in the simple things that many people overlook, like being in shape, watching your weight, picking nice clothes to wear, jewelry, glasses, earrings, all your accessories, well-groomed hair. Keep track of hair and clothing styles. Styles can change dramatically, and if we ignore fashion, our persuasive ability can be put in jeopardy. When in doubt, look to the national newscasters as a conservative role model in style. We all know we're not supposed to judge, but we do. And as Mark Twain said, clothes make the man. Naked people have little or no influence on society. Clothes are critical. People judge every aspect of the way you look and the way you dress. So that's the first one. That's attraction. The second one is similarity. Similar is familiar. Now, I didn't say identical. When two people show up to the party, for example, maybe in the same identical dress, that repels people. I'm talking about similarities. Similarity theory states that familiar objects are more liked than less familiar ones. This holds true with people. We like people who are similar to us, people that we can relate to. This theory seems to hold true whether the commonality is in the area of opinions, personality traits, backgrounds, or lifestyle. Now, consequently, those who want us to comply with their wishes can accomplish that purpose by appearing similar to us in a variety of ways. Studies show that we tend to like and are more attracted to those who are like us and with whom we can relate. You watch at a party, you'll see yourself and others instantly gravitate towards people who seem to be similar to yourself. I can remember walking in a foreign country, taking in the sights and the sounds, and running into someone from my own country. Wow, it created an instant bond. We could have been from opposite sides of the nation, but there was an instantaneous bond between us, all because we had something in common in a mutually unfamiliar place. Have you ever heard the saying, people buy from people they like? This is not only true in sales, but also even in the judicial system. When jurors feel that they share some common ground with you, and better yet, like you, even subconsciously, for that similarity, then you'll have a much better chance of winning your case. Anytime we establish something about ourselves that others will identify with, we increase our persuasive powers. In one particular study, anti-war demonstrators were more inclined to sign petition of those dressed in the same way. And many times they didn't even read the petition. They were dressed the same, and they signed it. We gravitate towards people who dress like us. Even in the 70s, when people tend to dress up in either the hippie style or the normal style, researchers studied the effects of clothing styles. What they did is the experimenters put on hippie or straight attire and then asked college students on campus for, way back then, a dime to make a phone call. When the experimenter was dressed in the same way as the student, the request was granted in more than two-thirds of all instances. When the student and requester were dressed differently, the dime was provided less than half the time. And numerous studies conclude that your audience is more responsive to individuals who dress and act similarly to them. A study done at Columbia University found something interesting. What the researchers did is they placed wallets on the ground, and in these wallets, $2 cash, a check for $26, and a personal ID of the owner, and a letter giving evidence that the wallet had already been lost before. The letter was written to the owner from the finder, expressing his intentions to return the wallet as soon as possible. The letter was sometimes written in perfect English, while other times it was written in poor English, as though created by a foreigner. Researchers wanted to see if the instances involved the wallet's return increased when finders felt some commonality with the writer of the letter. The study found that only 33% of the respondents returned the wallet when the person who wrote the letter was seen as dissimilar, while 70% returned the wallet when they thought they were similar to the letter writer. Do you remember those cliques in junior high or even high school or even college or even in the workplace? People associate and interact with those they view as similar to themselves. Cliques are often based on such commonalities as gender, age, education, background, professional interests, hobbies, and ethnic background. In one study, researchers examined the social networks of prison inmates. Their cliques were typically centered around commonalities of race, geographical origin, or even the types of crime committed. But then during the study, they noticed three men who stood out to the researchers because they had a tight companionship, but they really had no common background. And just as the study was coming to a close, the three men escaped together. This occurrence demonstrated that we also build alliances based on common goals. And then researchers McCroskey, Richard, and Daly say there are four critical steps to similarity: attitude, morality, background, and appearance. Because when a prospect receives a persuasive message, the following questions are subconsciously asked. Does the speaker think like me? Does the speaker share my morals? Does the speaker share my background? Does the speaker look like me? Of the four similarity factors, attitudes and morals are the most important. Master persuaders are always looking for similarities or common beliefs to form the basis of common foundations with their prospects. We want to be persuaded by those who are like us and with whom we can relate. We see real-world examples of this in advertisements. We want to see people we can identify with, and the advertising execs accommodate us. When we see a particular commercial, we think, hey, he's just like me. He doesn't have time to pick up his socks either. That couple has a messy, cluttered house too. We see ads with the average Joe or Jill because they create similarity. Your audience will connect with you as they perceive similarity. A study done by O'Keefe found two important points regarding similarity and persuasion. First, the similarity must be relevant to the subject or issue being persuaded. Second, to persuade someone, the similarities must involve positive rather than negative qualities. For example, if you bring up horoscopes, oh, you're a Gemini, I'm a Gemini too, that really has nothing to do with that type of persuasive situation. Could backfire on you. Or you bring something up negative. Really, you're a convicted felon too? So am I. Where did you serve your time? Not going to help you out in the persuasive process. So two things to remember: positive and relevant. Which brings us to number three, people skills. Winning instant acceptance of others. Isn't it interesting? You have a room of 200 people. You say, do you have average, below average, or above average people skills? And 95% of the room will say above average. What's wrong with this picture? Everyone rates their people skills much higher than they actually are. Because people are nice to you. You think you're part of the crowd. You think they like you. But now it's time to take the blinders off and really see how your people skills rank. You see, the ability to work well with others tops the list for common skills and habits of highly successful people. Studies show that as much as 85% of your success in life depends on your people skills and the ability to get others to like you. In fact, the Carnegie Institute of Technology, or Carnegie, depending on what part of the country you're from, found that only 15% of employment and management success is due to technical training, or brains, while the other 85% is due to personality factors, or the ability to deal with people successfully. A Harvard University study also found that for every person who lost his or her job for failure to do work, two other people lost their jobs for failure to deal successfully with people. Let's face reality. If you're a manager and you have 10 employees, you need to fire two. You can come with all the excuses in the world, but the reality is you're going to fire the two you don't like. That is human nature. You see, in this era where technology is overtaking our lives, It is tempting to think that personality and the ability to deal with people are not important qualities. On the contrary, we crave personal interaction now more than ever. People still want to get to know you and like you before the doors of persuasion and influence are unlocked. We most often prefer to say yes to the requests of people we know and like. In fact, network marketing companies rely on people skills. Marketing techniques are arranged in such a way so as to capitalize on the fact that people are drawn to buy products from people they know and with whom they are friends. In this way, the attraction, the warmth, the security, and obligation of friendships are brought to bear on the sales setting. For example, at Tupperware home parties, the strength of the social bond is twice as likely to dictate whether or not someone will buy a product as is preference for the product itself. What does that mean? When you know them and they like you, it doubles your chance to be able to persuade them and buy something from you. You see, people skills are crucial because they have a huge impact on our success. First impressions are made with only 4 minutes of initial interaction with a stranger. So we don't have time not to have good people skills. We could write a whole book studying people skills, but let's address some of the most important and basic communication and interaction techniques. And it's not how well you think you're doing, it's how well your prospect's going to rate you. Because just remember, when it's time to persuade, it's too late to learn. When it's time to need your people skills, it's too late to learn. So let's talk about goodwill. Goodwill and persuasive practice comes courtesy of Dale Carnegie, one of the greats in terms of understanding human nature. He told us that by becoming interested in other people, you will get them to like you faster than if you spent all day trying to get them interested in you. Having goodwill entails appearing friendly or concerned with the other person's best interest. Aristotle said, "We consider as friends those who wish good things for us and who are pained when bad things happen to us." This caring and kindness means being sensitive and thoughtful. It means acting with consideration, politeness, civility, and genuine concern to those around us. It is the foundation for all interactions and creates moods of reciprocity. You will win hearts and loyalty through compassion. You invoke goodwill by focusing on the positives. Don't be harsh or forceful when dealing in areas where the other person is sensitive or vulnerable. Additionally, make statements and perform actions that show that you have the audience's best interest in mind. Another people skill is bonding. Essentially, name-calling works. One of the quickest ways to form an immediate bond with people is by using and remembering their names. How can you effectively remember a name? When someone tells you his or her name, clarify the pronunciation, clarify the spelling, relate the name to something, and use it again, quickly, before we forget. Research shows that if you use a person's first name at the beginning and end of a sentence, your chance of persuasion increases. It's so simple and easy to implement, which creates an instant bond. Don't use the old age excuse, "I can't remember names." Remembering someone's name is not a function of listening, it's a function of memory. If you program your brain not to remember names, that's exactly what's going to happen. But be careful and use it in a sincere manner, not like the telemarketers who call you up, "Hi, Jim. Well, Jim, good to talk to you, Jim." And they abuse the name calling scenario. And then, often overlooked, and a big surprise to me, humor. Now, I knew humor was a big aspect of persuasion, but the correlation is incredible. Using humor can be a powerful tool of persuasion for you. Humor makes a persuader seem more friendly and accepting. Humor can gain attention, help you create rapport, make your message more memorable. It can relieve tension, enhance relationships, and motivate people. The actor John Cleese once said, "If I can get you to laugh with me, you like me better, which makes you more open to my ideas. And if I can persuade you to laugh at a particular point I make, by laughing at it, you acknowledge its truth." Professional persuaders, such as advertisers, know that humor can be a powerful tool. Look at the amount of humor used in the television ads in the United States, the United Kingdom. Humor is a powerful form of connectivity. Now, I'm not asking you to be a stand-up comedian, but there are things you can use to increase humor or even get someone to just feel better about themselves on the inside. You have to understand your audience is either going to laugh with you or feel sorry for you, so make sure your humor works. You see, the use of humor can also distract your audience away from negative arguments or grab their attention if they are not listening. Once you've got people laughing, they're listening, and you can tell them almost anything. Humor may divert attention away from a negative context of a message, thereby interfering with the ability of listeners to carefully scrutinize it or engage in counter-arguing. If listeners are laughing at the jokes, they may pay less attention to the content of the message. For example, humor can soften up or disarm listeners. Remember, though, use it cautiously. Practice it. If used inappropriately, it can be offensive and may cause your audience to turn against you, to repel. Humor should only be used as a pleasant but moderate distraction. You know, as a rule of thumb, if you're not good at telling jokes, don't attempt it here. Be sure you have good material. Remember that non-funny humor is not only ineffective, it can be very irritating. Cater your humor so that it's appropriate for your audience. Another one we notice with top persuaders, a smile. Now, how much does a smile cost? It's free, it's contagious, it's disarming. The safest way to increase people skills is give away smiles. It generates a great first impression and shows happiness, acceptance, and confidence. Your smile shows that you're pleased to be where you are, meeting this person. As a result, he in turn becomes more interested in meeting you. Smiling also conveys a feeling of acceptance, which makes your listener more trusting of you. It has also been shown that sales reps who smile during a sales process increase their success rate by 20%. However, as with traditional humor, use a smile appropriately. And then another, respect. In order for your audience to take your message seriously, they have to have some level of respect for you. The more they respect you, the more successful you will be. Building respect often takes time, but there are things you can do to facilitate it. You need to show gratitude, be thankful of others, and for what they do for you. Never, and I mean never, criticize others or talk about your problem. Never criticize the competition. People want to talk about two things, themselves or their problems. And if you listen when people tell you their problems, they will think you are wise and understanding. Remember, how someone feels about you is often influenced by how you make him feel about themselves. Being the person who makes people feel good will go a long way toward increasing your likability in their eyes. And the fourth, rapport, that instant connection. Rapport is the secret ingredient that makes us feel tangible and a harmonious link with someone else. It is equivalent of being on the same wavelength with the other person. Rapport is the key that makes mutual trust materialize. Have you ever met a perfect stranger and just hit it off? Finding plenty to talk about, and you felt as you've met them before, it just felt right. You felt so comfortable, you talked about anything, and you lost track of time. You developed such a strong bond with that person that you knew what they were going to say. Everything just clicked between the two of you, and you felt very close to this person. It could be a physical attraction, or it might just entail being on the same wavelength. You feel your ideas are in sync and you enjoy your time together with each other. This is rapport. When there is rapport, we can differ in our opinions with someone else, but still feel a connection or bond with that person. Rapport can exist between two people who share very few similarities. So while we talk about rapport, I want to elaborate on two concepts, body language and mirroring. Both of these will help you develop rapport much faster. Whether we realize it or not, we are constantly reading and being read by others. Even without the utterance of words, language of body speaks volumes. Often interpreting body language is a subconscious thing. We may not make a conscientious effort to think through all the details of why someone has just folded their arms across their chest and narrowed their eyes at us, yet somehow this body language registers enough subconsciously that we feel uneasy. The subconscious instantaneously interprets these actions to indicate expressions. Actions to indicate resistance, suspicion, or spite, even if we have not made a conscious study of the opposing person or their background. Reality is every gesture you make attracts or repels your prospects. You can learn to read people like a book. You see, using body language to its fullest not only involves mastering your own use of outward gestures to create and maintain rapport, but it also entails acquiring the ability to read the body language of another person. When you can effectively read body language, you can identify the emotions and the discomfort of others. You can see tension, anger, indifferent, disagreement, frustration, resentment. You have to understand that your body language adds or detracts from your message. In other words, your subconscious gestures and expressions can either hurt or help your ability to persuade others. You can create rapport by understanding and adopting the right body postures and countenances of your prospect. Everything about you, be it outward or subtle, communicates something to somebody else. You are always communicating. The words you use, your facial expressions, what you're doing with your hands, your tone of voice, and your level of eye contact will determine whether people accept or reject you and your message. To be persuasive, you have to present not only openness, but also authority. One of the experts in the field, Albert Mehrabian, says we are perceived in three ways. 55% is visual. That's your body language. 38% is vocal. That's your tone of voice. And 7% is verbal. The spoken words, the actual words you use. Other research estimates that as much as 93% of your message's impact depend on nonverbal elements. This includes your facial expressions, body movements, vocal cues, and even the study of proxemics. The study of space. How close could people be to you before you feel uncomfortable? Body language and gestures are an innate part of our psyche. There have been many interesting studies conducted on body language and the use of gestures. In one particular study, 12 children with perfect vision and 12 children who were blind since birth were observed to see if either group gestured more than the other. The results show that blind children actually gestured just as much as their full-sighted counterparts, even when they knowingly spoke with other blind children. The researchers concluded that gesturing is an innate part of our expressions and that speech and body language are highly interconnected. Furthermore, the researchers asserted that speech and body language also bear strong ties to our thought processes. An article in the American Journal of Psychology talked about how gesturing can serve as a memory aid. Subjects had more difficult time remembering words when they had to keep their hands holding onto a bar than when their hands were free. Understand there's a direct correlation between our ability to read body language and our relationships. Another study done at a college, students were tested to see if they could accurately identify the meanings behind certain facial expressions and tones of voice. The researchers consistently showed that the students who made the most errors in interpreting the meanings were those who had troubled relationships or greater feelings of depression. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The eyes of men converse as much as their tongues." And you hear, "The eyes are the window of the soul." Through our eyes, we can gauge truthfulness, intelligence, attitudes, and feelings of the speaker. Not making eye contact when we ought to can have devastating results. When Pennzoil Oil took Texaco Oil Company to court over Texaco's alleged interference with a contract Pennzoil was getting with Getty Oil, what happened is throughout the trial, Pennzoil's counsel was accused of trying to sway the jury by encouraging their witnesses to make eye contact and joke with the jurors. But Texaco, to show that they were serious and didn't consider this a laughing matter, told their witnesses not to joke at all and to avoid eye contact with the jurors. Unfortunately, the advice proved to be unwise and cost Texaco dearly in the end. Pennzoil was granted more than $2.5 billion in damages, the largest damage award in U.S. history. Why? When they talked to the jurors afterwards, they expressed distrust toward the witnesses who had avoided eye contact, even going as far to call them arrogant and indifferent. See, our eyes, our pupils, are one of the most sensitive and complicated parts of our body. They react to light, but they also respond to our emotions, betraying a variety of feelings. When a person is aroused, interested, receptive, their pupils dilate. This is an attempt by the eye to allow the entry of more light and more information. Being able to see each other's pupils is so important to our communication that we often distrust a person wearing sunglasses. Consciously or subconsciously, we assume that the use of glasses is a direct attempt to hide the eyes in fear that they will reveal the truth. Making eye contact can also convey love or passion. In a number of studies on eye contact and attraction, researchers found that simply looking into one another's eyes can create passionate feelings. In one particular case, two members of the opposite sex who were complete strangers were found to have amorous feeling towards each other after merely gazing into one another's eyes. In another study, beggars were interviewed about their tactics, about getting donations from those walking by. Several of the beggars stated that one of the very first things they tried to do was establish eye contact. They claimed that making eye contact made it harder for people to pretend they hadn't seen them, to ignore them, or just to keep walking. Other studies have shown that public speakers that make more eye contact, use pleasant facial expressions, and incorporate appropriate gestures in their speeches have more persuasive power than speakers who do not. Then our hands. The way we use our hand tells others a lot about what we are thinking or feeling. Even the way we shake hands. For example, if your hands are tucked away in your pockets or behind your back, you may be perceived as holding something back. Clenched fists may portray anger or tension. Holding your hands up around your face, over your mouth, by your ear, may portray dishonesty. Stroking your chin shows you're thinking about what has been said. If you place your hands flat on the table in front of you, you may be sending a signal that you agree. On the other hand, placing your hands on your hips may express defiance or dominance. And back to shaking hands. Even if we don't realize it, a firm handshake conveys cooperation, alliance. Weak or limp handshakes, on the other hand, portray just that, weakness, incompetence, and maybe even distrust. Be sure your hands are always firm and appropriately energetic. Then there's your head. If you notice your prospect tilting his head towards you, it's very likely that he is interested in the deal. If his head is tilted away, however, he may not be totally sold. And in fact, he may feel some distrust or dissatisfaction towards you or the offer. If he rests his head on his hand, he is bored or not really interested. If he keeps looking around, you can bet he is most likely thinking, "Get me out of here. Tell this person to shut up. I need to leave." And of course, nodding his head up and down would express agreement and interest. What about the legs? If your prospect is pointing his feet in your direction, he is most likely facing you and is therefore likely to be very interested in your offer. If his legs or feet are pointed away from you, he may be enduring your pitch and may be feeling ready to leave as soon as he has the opportunity. If his legs are crossed while he stands, he may still be feeling some awkwardness about the deal. On the other hand, if the legs are crossed when he is seated, he may be feeling some resistance to you or your offer. If his legs are tucked up under the bottom, he feels comfortable in your presence and enjoys visiting with you. If he keeps tapping his foot, he is either wishing you would be quiet and let him talk, or he's feeling bored. We can study nonverbal communication all day. We've done extensive research on detecting deception. There are so many things that you can do to read a person like a book. Another interesting aspect of rapport showing up on the radar screen at the Persuasion Institute is touch. Touch is a powerful part of body language, important enough to talk about. Touch can be a very effective psychological technique. Subconsciously, most of us like to be touched. It makes us feel appreciated and liked. It is true, though, that we do need to be aware and careful of a small percentage of the population who dislikes being touched in any way. Now, I'm not giving you permission to go around goosing people. There are appropriate ways to do this. Because in most instances, touch can help put people at ease and make them more receptive to you and your ideas. Understand, touch can create a positive perception in the person being touched. Touch carries with it favorable interpretations of immediacy, affection, similarity, relaxation, and informality. In one research study, librarians did one of two things when handing back library cards to university students. So they were checking out books, they were handing them their library cards. Either they did not touch the person at all during the exchange, or they made light physical contact by placing a hand over the student's palm. Invariably, those students who were touched during the transaction rated the library service more favorably than those who were not touched at all. Waiters and waitresses who touched customers on the arm when asking, "Is everything okay?" received larger tips and were evaluated more favorably than those waiters who did not touch their customers at all. Attractive waitresses who touched their clients, of course, received the highest tips of all. Touch also induces customers to spend more time shopping, and they tend to evaluate the store more favorably. In another example, touch was found to increase the number of people who volunteer to score papers, sign petitions, return money. Dr. Hornick discovered that touching bookstore customers on the arm caused them to shop longer and evaluate the store more positively than the customers who had not been touched. Even supermarket customers who had been touched were more likely to taste and purchase food samples than the non-touched customers. Now, we know that certain areas of the body can be freely touched while others are off limits. Women have more leniencies with other women and men. Men usually don't mind being touched by an unfamiliar female, but things get harder to predict in cases where men are touching other men. In general, men don't like being touched by unfamiliar members of the same sex, but realize there are safe areas to contact. Shoulders, forearms, hands, and sometimes the upper back. This all depends on the situation, the relationship between the two parties prior to the touch. The second aspect of rapport, remember the first one was our nonverbal gestures, the second one is mirror and matching. Many studies have been done. John Grinder and Richard Bandler made it famous by titling it mirror and matching. See, the idea is to align your movements and body image with your prospect's demeanor. Mirror and matching. Reflect their actions, but not imitate them. If people think you're imitating them, they'll feel like you're mocking them, and of course you'll have the opposite effect. They will be offended. They will see you as phony and no longer trust you. Instead of directly imitating, just mirror match the overall tone and demeanor of your prospect. You can mirror things like language, posture, moods, and gestures. See, when you mirror your prospects, you build rapport with them. Because of your similar demeanors, your prospects will feel connection with you. Remember, people are inclined to follow and obey those they perceive as similar to themselves. If they shift in their posture, you eventually do too. If they cross their legs, you cross your legs as well. If they smile, you smile too. When you do this, your prospect will subconsciously feel that you have much more in common with them than is actually the case. Remember, this is a natural part of human nature. This happens naturally when you develop rapport with somebody. you are just speeding up this natural process. Have you ever noticed at social gatherings how people tend to match others in their body language and their attitudes? For example, when two people greet each other, they typically tend to use the same posture and behave in the same demeanor. When you become a master persuader, you will make skillful and a conscientious use of mirroring. You see, you can mirror language. You'll be amazed at the effectiveness of using the prospect's same vocabulary, or what do you want to call it, lingo? Pick up on it. Use some of the words or phrases that your prospect uses. Make it sound natural and sincere. You may also find it helpful to mirror his rate of speech. If he speaks in a slower and more relaxed tone, you can do the same. Nevertheless, be sure to keep the enthusiasm high. If he speaks quickly, feel free to do the same. Even breathing becomes a natural process of mirror matching. Matching their voice, not their accent. You don't want to mimic, but this is the actual tone and inflection of your prospect's voice. What about mood? When you reflect your prospect's mood, you give validation to what he is saying and feeling. We often verbally mirror another's mood by restating what he or she just said. So what I hear you saying is, or I think I would feel that way too, if I also experienced, and then, you know, fill in the blank. Be sure when you mirror your prospect's mood that your tone is very sincere. When you sincerely acknowledge your prospect's comments, concerns, and feelings, your persuasive power increases. Then, of course, there's energy level. Some people seem to be relaxed and mellow, and if you come across with too much energy, you will clash. You mirror their energy level, and your goal, of course, is to bring it up. This technique is also effective when giving a group presentation. Match the overall energy level present in the room, or adopt the level of energy emanating from the group. As you study persuasion, you must realize that connecting with your audience is critical. Remember the numbers? 90% chance when they like you, 10% chance when they don't like you. What many persuaders don't know how to do is maintain the rapport through the entire persuasive situation. You see people in sales break the ice, find similarities, build rapport for the first 5 minutes, then they launch into the presentation. Their demeanor changes. All of a sudden they get serious, and something's different in the eyes of the prospect. What's the prospect going to think? The person that's been talking for the first 5 minutes has now changed. Well, who's the real person? The two are getting along, having fun, then all of a sudden, without warning, the salesperson becomes serious and dives into a sales pitch. And it gets even worse when they get closer to the close. This breaks rapport and seems incongruent to the prospect. And you're doing it. And you don't even know that you're doing it. You both know why you're there and what the ultimate goal will be, so continue to build rapport. They know they're in a persuasive situation. But let's back up and understand, connectivity takes time, research, and practice to master. Remember, the first time you try anything, whether it be a sport or a new game, it's awkward at first because it's the first time you've tried it. You need to learn how to read your prospect and your customer. Learn how to determine whether your prospect is relaxed, nervous, and confident, or indifferent. Mastering connectivity will make you a top-tiered persuader.